Enhancer. You started off busking on the streets, and now in the most recent film months, you're playing a busker. How did that work out?
Yeah, it was the kind of the first thing I suppose that attracted me to the idea was the chance to get back on Grafton Street and sort of see what it was like. You know, I left school at 13, and my headmaster was this guy Frankie Byrne. He was actually a DJ, and in Ballymun Comprehensive, and he was like, Glenn, you can tell me who played on, you can tell me the bass player on Neil Young's Harvest, you can tell me the track list on Bob Dylan's Street Legal, but you can't tell me the square root of six. And you know, and so, you know, you're into music, go and do it. So I went, and so the film was kind of a return to something that I knew very, very intimately.
But you had done The Commitments, though, hadn't you? And you didn't enjoy that experience as much, did you?
I did, actually. No, I did. I really enjoyed doing The Commitments. What I didn't enjoy was the 10 years after it, which was so you're in the frames, yeah. So tell us, what was it like being The Commitments? What was Alan Parker like? And so that whole experience for me was like, I don't know, I guess I never trusted it. I just never thought it was very, I never thought it was actually very true to Roddy Doyle's work, actually.
But this is John Carney's movie?
Yes.
And it's doing very, very well.
It is. It's doing huge business. It's we made this thing like for 120 grand. We shot it in 17 days. We planned to make like 1,000 copies and try to get Frames fans to buy it in order to try and make the money back. That was the idea.
And it went to the Sundance Festival and things started changing.
It went to the Sundance Festival and it won. And it's come out in the States and it's doing really well. And I guess we're all just sitting back and going, Jesus, you know, like brilliant.
It was the third biggest grossing movie in the States this month.
I know.
That's mad.
No, it's brilliant.
And I heard some rumour maybe one of the songs might be nominated for an Oscar. Is there? There's talk of something like that
whispers,
happening.
There's whispers. We'll see.
Good luck with it. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Beside me here now I have Colm Tobin and Pat McCabe. Colm Tobin, you're the president of the Listowel's Writers Week and the festival opened this evening. How did the opening go?
It was really great because it's always a wonderful occasion. There were about 700 or 800 people there and there were prizes given to, you know, every category. And I mean, the way the children came up, the way just a number of different prizes, and the whole sense, what it's about really is the whole sense of a whole town believing in the word and believing this is important. And as readers and also as people who lived here in a place where, you know, John B. Keane put it on the map, Brian McMahon, Brendan Kennelly, that business here of the importance of the word and the fact that some of John B. Keane's plays have been difficult plays for this community here, and there's never been that sort of problem of, why don't you go to London with your plays? You know, that he always had a group of actors working with him, or at least at the beginning he did. And that spirit is still here. And there's a great sense here always. I mean, I came here first a long time ago, and that opening night is always amazing.
Pat, this is your first time around this side of the woods, is it?
It is indeed, Warwick.
And how did the opening go for you?
Exactly as Colm says. It was kind of wonderful. But what really struck me was the value placed on the contribution of the children. I really have to say that was quite extraordinary. There were everybody down from the kind of initially sullen adolescent, who blossomed, I noticed, after he got his prize. Ronnie Dyle says success has already gone to his head. But there were about 15 or 20 children there. And it was kind of, they've got name badges and everything, you know. I mean, it was kind of beautiful, really.
It's great to see the next generation coming along.
Well, it's a lot better than, go on, England, write your books, isn't it?
Well, there's a certain confidence in our own culture now in these days. But, Colm, you recently talked at a conference about culture in Ireland. You asked questions as, what happens if we don't pay for culture? What is culture and how do we know when we see it? Is culture middle class? And you talked about 1971, Hitching to Gory, and this being your first engagement with culture.
Yeah, I read an article on the Enniscorthy Echo that there was a new art centre in Gory and it was run by Paul Funge. And because Paul Funge's father had been involved in the War of Independence with my family, they thought this was cool, you know, that the Funges were good people. And I went up there, and it turned out to be. And Paul Funge was a visionary person. He himself was a painter. And what he believed in was that there were no gaps, or that there were no distances between art forms, so that he put on a festival every year, and in the summer, and you could have the Clancy Brothers one night. You could have, I saw Jack McGowran doing his Beckett one man show when I was 16 years old in the town of Gory, and the next night,
the Gory Detail.
And I wrote, my first poems were published in the Gory Detail, my first stories were published in the Gory Detail. The next night, Liam Clancy would be on the same stage. The next night, the local theatre group would be on. There was an amazing episode where the Chieftains came, and everyone thought they were at a ballad session, and they could clap along with the chieftains. And they were made very clear by people, you know, that you listen to these people. Your job is to... And that was a key moment in Gori, you know, where you learned, everybody in the audience as well, you learned a great deal. All the world came to Gori. I mean, the painters came down with their exhibitions on. But the main sense, the main issue was that just because there's no such thing as high culture or low culture, there's just something on every night. And if you have the, you know, and the tickets were low, and it was a small town, there could be like immensely modern piece of sculpture in the middle of all this, or paintings that were like.
And how did the conservative Gori react to this?
They came to it. That's what they did. I mean, they just came to it. I mean, most evenings the events were full. And this was not Arts Council policy at the time, that there should be events like this in the regions. It didn't come from on high, a declaration, let's, you know, every town should have a festival. I mean, it came directly from one man's vision of what could be done in a community of people. Like, just like, if you put things on, someone will come. And also, like, I didn't know what a famous Jack McGarren was, and I'd never read Beckett. Somebody told me this was amazing. Oh, yeah, Robert Armstrong was a friend of mine. He's a painter, and he was the stage manager. Said, this guy.
He's good, like, get down and
when
see him.
The lights went up on this face of his. And, I mean, it was packed out. John Ashbery, the American poet, came. All sorts of classical musicians came, you know. But it was a golden time for me, because by the time I'd gone, because I was in school in Wexford, I had gone to rehearsals at the Wexford Opera Festival and to dress rehearsals, where there were really cheap seats. So I had seen, by the time I was 17, I had seen grand opera.
And Beckett.
As though it was Norman and Beckett and Liam Clancy. You know, and the chieftains.
Pat and Clonus, they had the same sort of menu, edgy in culture.
No, it's very interesting what Colm was saying. I remember that magazine, The Gori's Detail. I remember Paul Fudge in it. But I wonder, was Ireland so different in those days that a sense of wonder still obtained in the land at that time? And you know, that anybody knew coming to the town, whether it was Duffy Circus, was a huge event. And certainly Jack McGarren painted up, or in a Beckett play, would have been massive. So everybody would definitely come. I could imagine now, if you brought the New York Philharmonic Orchestra and put them on the Fair Green in any town, people might go because they're watching Big Brother.
We have a thing in common where the All-Ireland Flat Kill was in Clonus in 66.
Correct, yeah.
And then Escorthy in 67. And that was something to behold, wasn't it, Pat?
Yeah, exactly. You see, because the sense of wonder was huge then. Because, I mean, so little happened in a town of 2,000 people. I don't know what Enniscorthy is. I imagine it's not much more. But everyone got involved, like right from the 80-year-old grandmother to the 60-year-old. But now that's not the case, because the communities in small towns, such as they exist culturally, are more stratified. People don't interact at funerals the same way they did. They don't interact in small shops the way they did. So you could put
there
on...
There are no small shops.
There are no small
shops. You have to go to a garage.
So we're looking at a time which actually probably is golden and amber lit in some way. But it's not possible to repeat it. And there were very few and far between. I'd say if you tried to find how many similar festivals or events or happenings, as you might call them, had happened in Ireland at that time, there'd be very few and far between.
Yeah, but I mean, in that talk, in the lecture I gave, I was talking about Frederick May, who I met as an old man, as a broken composer, that he'd written his string quartet in 1936. It was 10 years before it was performed. He had to work in the Abbey Orchestra. Ernest Blyth picked on him. And just the idea that someone, this string quartet is one of the greatest pieces of Irish beauty of the 20th century, left neglected for so long. He himself neglected for so long. And that sense, at least that's over. You know, while the wonder of something new coming to a town might be over, at least that sense that somebody working at the
but
highest level...
You talked about the same thing, Pat, recently, about Flann O'Brien and the lads in the 50s swilling the whiskey. If they had opportunities like university education, bursaries, travel grants, that they would have blossomed into greater artists, perhaps.
If they hadn't drank
it. If they had the opportunity of university and bursaries and travel.
And I think that they were the generation that really suffered badly because of their responsibilities to their families and everything else. That there was civil service generations. They seemed to me to be the generation that had to take the hit for the end of the romantic republican dream. Now we have to build the roads. Now we have to build the houses. Now we have to... And it's not that easy. And 200 or 300, maybe 100 years has to pass. As we're looking at it now, perhaps the only fruition of what this whole idea was of building a proper modern state was all about. But it was a huge price to pay, I think, really. And like, I'm not lamenting the end of this state of wonder. I think Colm was absolutely right there. I mean, I don't want to see anybody broken. I'm just making an observation. I'd far rather have it the way it is now, whether international travel is effortless to people.
Then the way it was. Glenn, you talked about your headmaster being the inspiration for you for...
Yeah.
Very enlightened headmaster, wasn't it? Like, get out of school there and go play music.
He was an unlikely headmaster, but I did grow up in an unlikely kind of a community. We had a priest, for instance, just the lads talking about the sense of wonder when Duffy's came to town. I remember when we were kids, if the circus came to Ballymun, it was like a really, really big deal, but most of us were trying to rob whatever was... what was tied down.
Who speaks about the same thing as Bob Dylan in Hibbing?
Really?
Yeah, exactly the same thing about Duffy's circus. Obviously, it wasn't Duffy.
Yeah, yeah.
But when the circus came, he said, I kind of really understood the notion of duality. And where he said, like, the guy could be a magician one minute, and next he's a red Indian.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And there was a great priest in our community, Father Martin. He was a Franciscan. And he was one of the, for some reason, the thing about growing up, certainly where I grew up, was that all the junkies, as much as they were looked down on by the community, they were actually the coolest people. They were the ones that loved Pink Floyd and the ones that loved Dylan and Bob Marley. And I remember Father Martin got Christy Moore out to play in a tent in front of the flats one time. And the whole town, like thousands of people gathered around his tent, and Christy Moore was playing a set inside the tent for about... 300 lads who were kind of pretty strung out, and it really made a huge difference to the community. I remember, like, just that idea of arts coming to a small town and really waking everybody up to something else. Because, I think a lot of the social problems like junk and all the rest is just basically having no perspective. You grow up in an area, nothing really comes in or gets out, nothing penetrates. You don't feel like you have a voice in your country or your town. And so you kind of just you hang out with your mates and you disintegrate. Literally, you fall apart. Whereas this guy really, he was amazing. He really woke me, like, really inspired. A bit like the character you're talking about, really, he inspired the whole community by sort of going, actually, there's more out there,
Would you talk, Colm, in the article, I might even read a small bit from it here, that the spark that lit the fire in Wexford and Gorey came from individuals first, rather than from boards or policymakers. The arrows led them from officialdom in search of support. The job of officialdom was to listen to them, learn from them, respond to them, but not to speak. As a member of the Arts Council, do you think officialdom has done that?
Well, you can never say it enough that it is all over Ireland. There are talented individuals. I mean, at the Clifton Arts Festival, the places you've worked in, the figures...
Well, Ollie Jennings...
The figures such as Ollie Jennings in Galway. And the job of the Arts Council or the department or even the county councils is to seek out those individuals, and when they speak... listen to them very carefully and try and do what they say and don't speak back, certainly if I'm on the Arts Council, but the Arts Council is absolutely ready for this. I mean, in other words, there's no question of introducing a policy from the top down that everybody has to adhere to. I hope it's the opposite. And if it's not, it should be.
Well, of course, we have to negotiate the plague of administrators in the arts these days, to get to do anything. There's more administrators working in the arts than in artists, and strangely enough, But anyways, Pat, you're reading at the festival, you're doing a new project.
That's not really a new project, Park. It's just a kind of way of making readings more interesting for me, because, to be perfectly honest, even from the time that any of my books became popular, I've never really quite understood the notion of standing up and reading a book. I've always thought, well, why don't you just take the book home and read it? Why do you need me to read it to you? And I thought, well, unless it's got something really special to say as a performer or some unusual slant on it, well, why would anybody want to come and hear you read it? I mean, you've written it, that's enough. So
I saw you reading The Butcher Boy in 92 in New York in a tiny pub. And it was
I remember that, yeah.
The most exhilarating
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, you're a great reader.
Well, that's what I was hoping to say. Yeah.
I mean, God almighty. I remember you when you started reading.
Colm, you don't go to tricks to spice up your readings, do you?
It's not about tricks.
If you can bring in music, look.
Marvo the Magician. Like,
if you can bring in music.
What it is an idea, right, that started off like, I wanted to do this thing was really, like, I was fed up with everything being too flash, that everything was a little bit too squeaky clean. I thought a little bit of low tech in this world might be no harm. That everything is MP3s, flash forward, blah, blah, particularly in the film world. So what about sort of like old-time radio for the future? And I sort of started messing around with soundtracks and things like that. So one minute you would have Margaret Barry singing The Turf Man from RD, but then you would splice across it Nine Inch Nails, what the mark has been made. And while that on one level sounds like it's shock tactics, it's not. Because if you think of anything that I've written, which would be Emerald Germs of Ireland, which is a kind of a parody of Walton's Treasury of Irish Ballads. Equally in Winterwood, when the guy has a breakdown, you could see Nine Inch Nails being the interior of his mind. So it's not phony in that sense. It's not talk. So it was a matter of creating a kind of an imaginative world which could happen on stage, which sort of married the worlds that I would inhabit, would be like Patrick Kavanagh could equally meet Peter Wingard. I don't know if you know who Peter Wingard is.
I'm not familiar with Peter Wingard.
Peter Wingard was a kind of a lounge lizard from the early 70s programme Department S.
And he would never tell you that stage, Pat Beck said.
Well, no, I used to look at it down in number 4. That was the only television in the town. But Peter Wingard made a big impression. And I think that's what happened with the Sense of Wonder in those days. There was only one telly in the town. You remembered everything that was on it. You know, that's the difference.
But we're from the radio generation, the storytelling, the listening to the story, you know.
Oh, yeah, but it's very much part of that. It's very much Dinjo take the floor. It's very much like, you know, the Walton programme and all that. But it's a kind of a homage to the oral tradition, but with a bit of postmodern psycho future stuff mixed in. But I'm not just doing this on my own. I've got a few musicians and a couple of actors with me.
And it's excerpts from your work, like?
Yeah, yeah, and the bits and pieces they make up.
Colm, you're reading as well at the festival. What are you going to be reading?
I'm just done and boring. I'm just gone.
No, sorry, you go on home.
I wrote a story about a priest, you know, about a mother of an abusive priest. The story's called A Priest in the Family. And it's about what happens not to the abused person or to the priest, but what it'd be like to be the mother of someone like that in a small town where the news comes your son is actually an abuser and he's going to go to jail and he's a priest. So the story I'm going to read tomorrow is called A Priest in the Family.
Was that inspired by events in Wexford?
Yeah, in other words, I read the Ferns report and I was in St. Peter's College, Wexford, myself. And I thought various times of writing a novel directly about one of the priests. But I thought journalists had done that. All that's known. The court cases had been very well reported. But I wanted to sort of move it to the side just to see from just the side of your eye, the woman, the old woman coming out of the courthouse who's the mother of the priest and going home on her own. Like, what is she thinking? So I just thought that wasn't reported by any journalists. It's something that you can do in fiction. Enter into a tiny part of the picture and just take that. Yeah. So that's what I was doing.
And is that going to be published as a short story?
Yeah, it's in the book Mothers and Sons, which is already published. And so I'm going to read from that.
Great.
And I'm going to explain the context and do all that first. But I wish there was music. I can't think of a suitable music for that, you know. Maybe it's sort of a Tantumargo at the beginning
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, Osalo Taras host,
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That's some
yeah.
Gregorian chant.
Yeah, angels yeah. We have heard on high, yeah.
Well, I'm not sure any of those are appropriate for
my father didn't like me anyway.
Glenn, are you going to be singing in your concert? You're playing a concert?
I am. I'm playing Friday night in St. John's, yeah. Looking forward to it. And I'm doing a songwriting kind of workshop thing that's going to be basically 12 hours over 3 days, 4 hours a day. And I've written one thing. The only note I've taken for the whole thing is the love song. And I have to elaborate on that for 12 hours.
So you're going to do a 12-hour discussion on the love song?
I hope. Well, if it works out the way I hope it will, we'll sit down and we'll talk and we'll take it from wherever it starts.
And do you have loads of musicians? Which in the room or how does that process
start? It's going to be 15 people who are interested in the process of writing songs. Now, I'm not the get up in the morning, make a cup of coffee and get to work type, so I don't really know how I'm going to explain. I just do it. You know, because sure. We all have our processes. So
yeah,
I never even spoke about it before.
Yeah, well, I'm sure everybody in the room would really appreciate that. That'd be a lovely way to do it.
Well, that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping it's not like I paid loads of money to see, and all you're telling me is you can do it.
Yeah.
But going back to that thing about process, Colin, do you have a process? Do you have a ritual, a routine to get you through the working day, the writing day?
Finish everything I start.
Really? That's
what just that. Finish everything you start. And I have another thing called get on with your work. And I talk to myself and I just say those things. Finish everything you start and get on with your work.
Stop whinging and get on with the work.
Yeah, no emailing now today, thanks. Wow. No the phone and no, you know, needing coffee or anything. Just get on with it.
You wouldn't bother with the breakfast or nothing?
No, no. You should be in your mental pyjamas until the early afternoon.
Pat, do you stay in the mental pyjamas until the early afternoon?
What Glenn was saying about teaching, that was one thing. I met Billy Roach today and we were talking about the notion of workshops and everything. And all the years that I attended workshops, people taught about feelings and they taught about mood, but they never taught about plot. And I just wonder, that's surely something that you can teach people. And I wonder, is that the reason for that, people? Because people felt, well, a high art doesn't need plot, and yet the Greeks are full of plots and everything else. And I was just wondering if it's related to Glenn, the thing that I used to try and write songs when I was a kid, and I could never really get the structure of songs. I remember meeting a guy who said he hated the 60s. I said, why do you hate the Sixties? Because Dylan came in. He said, they destroyed the whole nature of song as I understood it. He was talking about Jerome Kearns and the Rodgers and Hammerstein when the arrangers would come in and there was a structure to a song. There was a plot. Now, if you know all that, then you can destroy it.
Exactly.
But what was the one about the song? You had the verse, the bridge and the chorus.
Yeah. Exactly. But even just explaining that to a 16 or 17 year old, you know what I mean? I would have loved to have known that that's the way it worked, or there were sequences that you could use. You
patterns,
know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that, you know, that you don't, then you don't make mistakes. Because if you're not told these at 16 or 70, then you make it up as you go along and you make mistakes.
Well, thanks for that, Pat. I'll definitely explain that tomorrow.
I think that's really important. That's what I would
important.
Be looking
intro,
for.
Intro, verse.
Yeah, that you take for granted.
Bridge, yeah, chorus.
And I'm sure dramatists take for granted. You know, that, oh, you don't have to worry about that. Well, if you don't know it, you worry about it.
Thank you. Then you
keep making mistakes.
Yeah.
And you have to go and unravel all this.
But in Winterwood now, did you have a very definite plot for it when you started off? Or?
No, but...
It doesn't seem to be very... It's not a heavily plotted novel, is it?
What I would say is that anything that I'd written up to that, I said, some of these are very, very weak in terms of story. And if there could have been an awful lot better if I'd spent more time building the scaffolding on which to build all the emotion. And Winterwood then, if you're dealing with... I mean, there's a book that is hugely influenced by that nobody has spotted except one reviewer, which was Confessions of a Justified Sinner by James Hogg, which is an extraordinary novel published in the 19th century. And a lot of it is taken from that. It's experiments in duality and twists and turns and unreliability. So in terms of, I said, rather than writing what I would have considered my book, I said, I would steal some of this. Stuff that clearly worked, of duplicity and lies and twists and turns, and it made it a much better book. So if you're dealing with a book that's layered, you know, there's seven or eight layers going on in it. If I hadn't have done that and paid attention to the plot, there would only be three or four layers in it. So for that reason, I think it's a better book. So it's a mathematical thing that I've kind of learned. I didn't need to be taught the other stuff, but I need to be taught that.
You need to be taught how to put a structure on the words.
I think I did, yeah.
Interesting.
Well, I hope that you'll get on with that tomorrow again and you'll be able to help people out in the workshop. You were performing St. John's on Friday night and you're doing the workshops tomorrow and Friday, and then we have you working tomorrow, Cullum, in the St. John's Centre at 5:30. Good luck with that. Thanks very much to Cullum Tobin, Pat McCabe and Glenn Hansard.